We are about to speak with another Georgia mom who has experienced the unimaginable. Join us today on Fostering the Future.
Welcome to the Fostering the Future podcast, a show about all things child welfare, dependency, adoption, and foster care. Here are your hosts, veterans in the world of child welfare, Jack and Kat.
We believe that every human has incredible and equal value regardless of what side of the courtroom we sit on. We hope that everyone feels welcome and accepted here on Fostering the Future.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook or Instagram as Fostering the Future Podcast, or check us out on our website at fosteringthefuturepodcast.org. This is Jack, and I am here with Christy, and today we are talking with Diana, a mom of three beautiful children in Georgia, and she's going to share her story with us today. Thank you so much for being with us today, Diana.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, we do have to initiate you by asking what your favorite beverage at Starbucks is.
I like triple espresso with steamed oat milk. I let them pick my flavor. It's squirrely like that.
So one of my kids has insomnia and has to have a cappuccino every morning. And my husband ran out of something this morning. So he told me to grab something on the way. So I'm not used to that. And this is for my 7-year-old. Dunkin' was the only thing on the way. So I stop and I'm like, listen, I need something with a lot of caffeine and really sweet. And they're like, well, what do you want? And they were like arguing with me. I'm like, can't you pick something sweet with a lot of caffeine?
Right.
He was fussing at me. I got up to the window and he's like, ma'am, I think you need to figure out what your son likes.
Yeah.
Give me something sweet.
Yeah, give him something sweet.
Well, they failed because he came home, had slept half the day at school, and the drink was almost still full. So,
Diana, can you tell us a little bit about you and your family?
Of course. Yeah. Me and my husband met in sixth grade, PE to be exact.
Really?
Yeah. Became really good friends. Ended up having our eighth grade year together in the same class. You know how kids flirt back then, when you pull each other's hair and I like you type of thing. And then we finally went on our first date that summer and we've been together ever since. I think we're about to celebrate 19 years of marriage. My mom asked me when I was, I think, 13, she was joking around me. She's like, you really like this boy, huh? And I was like, yeah, I do. She's like him. I was like, mom, I'm going to marry him. That's where the story began. The marriage was beautiful. The life was fun. And we instantly started trying to have kids. We got married at 21. We had to wait so we could toast with a glass of champagne. But we moved in together when we were 17. Always been together. You know, the first couple of years of marriage, pregnancy didn't happen. So we're like, something's up there. But we just took a break and got all the beautiful unsolicited advice of, oh, when you stop trying, it will happen. Or when you stop thinking about it, it will happen. You know, and then it just never happened. So we started IVF pretty early on. I started getting checked out around 25 to see what was up.
All three of your children were conceived through IVF. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Yeah, it was a long process. IVF is really expensive. I'm very proud of a lot more companies taking part of IVF, being a part of their insurance packages, which is amazing. I wish that happened for us back then, but a lot of people have to pay out of pocket. And when you're thinking about the expenses, depending on how severe your case is, it can be anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000. There's all these other treatments that they want to try first before they go to the more invasive IVF. So we did that for about 10 years unsuccessfully. And then we moved down to where we are here in Camden County and started with an amazing doctor at the Florida Institute of Reproductive Medicine. She's amazing. We went through IVF and we had our first daughter, Arabella, in 2019, which was amazing. So that was about 14 years into the IVF and infertility process.
A lot of people don't keep going that long. It's not just like a financial thing. It's an emotional thing. It's a body painful thing. That is a lot to be doing that for so long. But I guess the end result being your daughter, it all is worth it in that moment, right? When you look back and it's like, is this ever going to end? Is this ever going to work? And then you have your daughter and it's like, oh my gosh, I would have done that 10 more times.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you know, during the 14-year process, it wasn't nonstop. You have to take a break mentally, financially, you know, you do. It's a lot to go through for men, of course, too. But for women, you're injecting yourselves with all sorts of hormones. And it is just a crazy ride that you have to go through to get to the end results. And I just pray for and just feel so deeply for the families that have to go through that unsuccessfully. Because we were so blessed to have it work the first time, which is not normal, which we then would find out trying to give her siblings that our struggle would then continue for almost another 3 years. Losing embryos and unsuccessful transfers, miscarriages. And then we actually had to go through the entire IVF process again to try to give her a sibling.
How old was she when you decided to have more?
She was about a year and a half when we started transferring the remaining embryos that we had from the first cycle.
So then you get pregnant with twins.
Our last shot was a transfer in late October. She, at that point, was 2 going on 3. It was her 3rd birthday when we got official confirmation that we had a successful pregnancy at that point.
That must have been quite the birthday present for her. So I know we've got some rough stuff ahead. Can you kind of walk us through?
Yeah. And sorry if it becomes a lot, because it was a lot. And my first pregnancy was a breeze compared to this one. We officially found out we were pregnant early December. I got discharged from my infertility doctor to my OBGYN in January. Come February, I started complaining to her that I just didn't feel right. I'm getting lightheaded a lot, kind of seeing floaters and spots when I stand up. I feel like maybe my blood pressure is elevated, but at that point, I didn't have any way to check it. I was not gaining weight at all. So she did address that in the first trimester. I think by the end of it, maybe I had gained 6 pounds. The second trimester is when things really started getting abnormal for myself. I was complaining about severe edema in my legs. Like they would just randomly swell, especially my left leg would swell more than my right. They sent me to the ER a couple times, make sure everything was okay. Blood pressure's a little elevated. Nothing too concerning for them, but I kept trying to stress that my blood pressure always ran really low, like 110 over 60, 105 over 60. So 130 over 70 or 80 was concerning for me, made me feel abnormal, but they really didn't pay any attention to it because it didn't meet the threshold for hypertension. So I was written off on not having high blood pressure, continued to have these symptoms all through my second trimester. I would call almost every week with complaints of headaches, dizziness, severe swelling. I would gain 6 pounds overnight in swelling and then lose it, which I guess is all signs of either severe hypertension or borderline preeclampsia. My doctor then ordered what's called a protein check in your urine. No one told me how to do that properly. I didn't know you were supposed to keep it chilled. I live on the border of Florida. I'm riding around in a hot car, keeping a urine check for 24 hours. And I didn't know any better to keep it cold. So when I turned that in, it was in the normal range. I did that twice and they were both in the normal range. By the third time, the nurse said, okay, well, make sure you keep this on ice or in the fridge. And I just looked at her. I was like, what? What do you mean keep it in the fridge? And she's like, yeah, you have to keep it cold. And I was like, well, no one told me that. And here I am. I'm almost at the end of my second trimester.
What was that testing for?
When you are pregnant and you have protein in your urine, that means that you have preeclampsia. That's confirmation that your body is losing protein through your urine, which is very dangerous, not only for the mother, but for the baby. It affects the placenta function on how much blood flow it gets, how much oxygen, how much nutrition. It just affects your baby. So my third urine test, it finally came back positive for protein in my urine. And that's when I first got admitted into Baptist, which is connected to Wilson's in Jacksonville. And that was on June 13th. So right at the beginning of my third trimester, I believe. They're trying to get my blood pressure under control. And at the same time, I'm actually going into preterm labor. So it's kind of multiple things happening all at once. They treat me with IV fluids. I don't believe it worked. And then they put me on magnesium. And then they gave me 2 shots of steroids to make sure the baby's lungs developed in case they were born that early, which I guess is protocol. I'm not really sure. I think at that point, around 29 weeks, maybe 30, they officially diagnosed me with preeclampsia. And it was because of that admission to the hospital that we found out that she had severe intrauterine growth restriction because they checked on the babies at that point.
At this point, you're in your third trimester and the IUGR limits the blood flow, nutrient flow to the baby, thus affecting the baby's growth.
Right. It can in some cases, depending on how the severity of the growth restriction. Absolutely. Her measurement was under 1% on the growth scale. So that's what classified it as severe for her. Around the 29th, 30 week marker is when they found out, and I was then started being seen by a high risk doctor. They measured her at that point. They told me that she was measuring at 3 pounds, 2 ounces. And he was approximately 5 pounds is what they said. So there was a significant difference between the two. The blood flow, oxygen to his placenta was adequate. Hers was not. Not only does it mean that the blood flow and oxygen isn't adequate to the placenta itself, but it also means that the placenta she's in is not able to grow. So it essentially stays the same size. If the placenta stays the same size, she doesn't have room to develop.
And then she can't move as much.
Exactly. And so they would always ask me, do you feel your baby's sick? And I would always correct them. I feel Christian all the time, but I don't feel her. But they would kind of like, how do you know who's who? Since day one, I'm not joking, I freaked the ultrasound tech out on my very first ultrasound. I said, she's right here, he's right here. And she's like, how do you know that? I'm like, a mother just knows. And she's like, okay, we'll see. And she scans. And sure enough, I always knew which baby was which and where they were. She was always like way low and he was always on my side moving around, taking up all the space up top. That's when we found out she was severely intrauterine growth restricted, that there was such a difference between their weights. The high-risk doctor then started following my pregnancy and doing ultrasounds like every other day, not necessarily in for growth, but to make sure the blood flow was adequate to the placenta. And there was some abnormalities there, but for the most part, they said that it wasn't as concerning as I guess it could have been. And then they then reviewed with me at that point all the risks of having a natural birth, because that's what I was pushing for. Prior to that, I was on like light bed rest. When you start feeling lightheaded, go lay down. When you don't feel good, go lay down. Don't pick up your daughter. Don't do this. But at that point, I was on strict bed rest. So I was in the hospital from June 13th to the 16th or 17th. And then I was back admitted by June 23rd. And that's when they're like, no, you're on strict bed rest. You cannot move out of the bed. I think the whole pregnancy, I want to say I gained approximately maybe 25 pounds.
Especially with twins, that's...
Yeah, no, I gained 50 with my first. So I was obviously pretty concerned. I was in the hospital for almost 5 weeks. And the only time I was allowed out of the bed was for bathroom privileges. And every time I would get out of the bed, my blood pressure would just skyrocket. So they just weren't able to control it. At that point is when my lab started coming back abnormal. Every other day, it felt like, okay, look, if this doesn't resolve, you're going to have a C-section. It was just a constant emotional roller coaster of calling, hey, we might have a C-section tonight. Hey, we might have, if this doesn't resolve, we might have a C-section tonight. So if it wasn't my blood pressure and not being able to get under control. She had a concern about my kidneys at one point. And then finally the confirmation was that natural birth was off the table because he was breached and she was too small. The way it was explained to me verbally in the room was she's so small and where she's at in the canal, if she were to get stuck and you start contracting, it could cause serious damage to her. I was like, well, then obviously that's off the table. Then C-section it is. I know since I was losing weight, the doctor had doubled my portion intake. Like, so every meal at the hospital, they gave me double the portions. They gave me protein shakes because my protein, like, in my blood was extremely low. And then also my calcium was low, even though I was on prenatal vitamins and all of that.
You had low calcium despite being on prenatal vitamins to supplement you with calcium. Did they ever check your vitamin D as well?
They never did.
Calcium, I know, is also really important for bone development. Obviously, they should know that that's an issue.
Looking back, I do find it curious. I'm like, so why would you check for low calcium and not low vitamin D? But, you know, at that point, who am I to question it?
Who would have known?
Right. Well, before this, I was blindly thinking that doctors always are going to do what's in the best interest of their patients. And this has given me a rude awakening.
Yeah, all of us for sure. So you ended up having a C-section.
Yeah, on July 2nd.
How did that go? Was everybody born healthy?
So we had an emergency C-section because, again, I went into labor. So this was maybe the third or fourth time that my body went into labor. So if you think about what labor is, you know, obviously it's your body contracting. If she's so low, as they always said she was, and your body's contracting, what is that doing to her internally? It would take hours and hours, if not days, for them to stop the labor. So every time I'm contracting and contracting, it's just things you don't think about until, like you said, we have the emergency C-section and she's born. She's born at 3 pounds, 4 ounces. So we're talking 5 weeks later on strict bed rest, she gained 2 ounces.
C-section, they come out, they're both probably a little small. Were there any other medical issues that they could tell from the jump? What happened at that point?
Yeah, no, they went straight to NICU. I got to see Christian, briefly got to see Amelia. It wasn't like your normal put the baby up next to mom and get a picture. They just showed him to me around the curtain and then just rushed him right off to NICU. Christian, they brought because he was having some breathing issues and he was put on like a little CPAP machine to help him breathe. And then Amelia was having issues with controlling her body temperature, her glucose. They were both put on feeding tubes.
How long were they in the NICU?
So Christian wasn't in there as long as Amelia. Christian was in there just for a few weeks. Amelia was in there for 42 days. I don't know if she should have been released when she was. She was under 5 pounds when she was released. But we were just so eager to have our family home and complete because at that point we were living in the Ronald McDonald House, which is an amazing facility for families that need to be close to their little ones in the hospital. But it's not home. It's not where you expect to bring home your newborn. So it's me and my toddler and my son, you know, living in essentially kind of a hotel room. Me and my husband taking turns running back and forth to NICU to visit Amelia. My husband went up there and stayed 24 hours a day and got her to drink all of her bottles. And so when the doctor did his rounds the next day, he said, well, I see she took all her bottles from you. You want her to go home? And he's like, yeah, of course I want her to go home. They discharged her and she came home. But looking back at it, I don't think she was ready. I think she should have stayed a little longer.
What diagnosis did she leave the NICU with?
I think she had like a borderline failure to thrive. She had anemia. She was still under 1%. Even at her first pediatrician appointment, she wasn't on the growth scale. She had to be on a special preemie nipple and she never really latched very well without a guard, but I would breastfeed her, but she did better with her bottles. She did it very slowly. She would throw up a lot. She threw up a lot in NICU too with her tube feedings. And that's something that I'm in a battle with to try to do an amendment of records since October, because she actually she choked in NICU on one of her tube feedings. And thank God I was present for it. They would go in and they'd give her tube feeding. And then towards like the middle of her feeding, they would give her her Polyvisol, which I don't know if you know what Polyvisol is. It stinks. There's no one in this world that's going to like the taste of Polyvisol. So normally they would do a pretty good job of mixing it in with her milk so she didn't taste it. I was over pumping in the corner of the room and I watched the nurse run in and say, I'm giving her vitamins. I said, okay. And I, you know, see her put it in her tube and my baby girl swaddled on her back. I'm just pumping in the corner. And then out of the corner of my eye, I just see an abnormal movement. Like as a mom, you just have that sixth sense, that tuition. And I'm like, what, why is she moving like that? And so I stopped pumping. I went over there to check on her. And sure enough, her face is purple. And there's a teeny tiny little dribble of brown coming out of her mouth. I'm waiting for something to happen, waiting for a team of nurses to rush in. Nothing happens. And I instantly just grab my baby, unswaddle her, flip her over, support her neck and her head. And I start patting her back. And I'm still waiting for someone to come in. I turn her over. She's still purple. She's not breathing. She's like flailing, like her body is jerking. I can't tell you what the numbers were, but I know like green is good. Yellow is not good. Red is really bad. I know I look at her vitals and it's red and yellows. Still no one is in the room. I just screamed out for help. And finally her nurse came in and I said, she's choking. She's choking. Her nurse comes to my left in front of her and tells me, keep stimulating her back, keep stimulating her back. She starts giving her oxygen and the charge nurse rushes in to my right. There's nurses all behind me. She starts suctioning out her mouth. Everyone's instructing me to continue stimulating her back. And I'm just watching her vitals drop and her body just jerk because she can't breathe. And finally, I just feel her little butt just go limp in my hand. She's stopped moving altogether. She stopped struggling. And so I just screamed out again, please, dear God, just save my baby. And that's when they told me to lay her down. And I laid her down. And I watched her shift nurse rip open the bag manual ventilator, you know, like you see in the movies where they rip open a bag and they start pumping her with oxygen. And I back away and everyone surrounds her little incubator and they keep pushing her to the side, suctioning, turning her over, bagging her. And they keep doing that for I don't know how long. All I notice is that she wasn't purple or red anymore. She was just gray. And then I finally heard them say, she's throwing up. She's throwing up. I never heard her cry. And then her oxygen started slowly going up. I can't tell you how long the incident lasted. It felt like forever. The shift nurse came over and hugged me so many times, just saying, I'm so glad you were in the room. And at that point, as a mom, you're just so grateful your baby's breathing again. Like, I didn't even think, like, what did that just do to my baby? And until all this happened, I didn't even think twice about it. First off, it was so traumatic. For me personally, I had a really hard time going back into that room after that. I hate to admit it because it made me feel so bad because no one should ever feel their baby go lifeless in their hand. She was only 22 days old at that point. It happened on 7/24. Like, I'll never forget it. It's like burned in my mind. Her alarms did not go off.
And if you hadn't screamed, nobody was coming in, right?
I'm thinking that's why it wasn't documented properly. So when I called the charge nurse and asked if her equipment was being checked, she was very harsh and said, why would we do that? And I said, because her alarms didn't go off. Oh, she's like, I was in the room with you. And I said, I'm so sorry. It was very traumatic. If you were in the room, I apologize. There was a lot of people in the room when that happened. She's like, yeah, I heard you scream. I said, well, that's exactly my point. I had to scream because the alarms weren't going off. Oh, no, I heard the alarms. I said, so which one is it? Did you hear me scream for help or did you hear the alarms go off? And she kind of just went silent on me. the shift nurse was super supportive and sweet. She hugged me so many times and said, "I'm so grateful you were in the room." She looked at me and said, "Your baby would have died if you weren't in there." I had no idea she was choking. Her alarms did not go off.
And this is at the Baptist Hospital that's connected to Wolfson's?
This happened at Wolfson's.
This was at Wolfson's.
I'm surprised they didn't shove you out of the way.
Someone should have taken her out of my hands.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. With as many nurses that were standing behind me, someone should have taken her out of my hands, because there, at that point, there was probably six people in the room, not including myself. She should have been checked after that. She should have had that. She should have been made sure there was no injuries. But I've been fighting with Wolfson's ever since, because after all this happened, I logged into her portal being like, "Oh my goodness, they say they found posterior healing rib fractures. Me hitting a 4-pound baby in the back when she's choking." And I log in her portal. There's nothing there for that date. Nothing. There is no documentation of the incident at all in my portal. So I immediately do an amendment, a record request in October after all this happened. Instantly, I filed. So we are 7 months in on a process that normally takes 30 to 90 days maximum. And they still can't give me an answer on whether they can amend the records to reflect the incident. We found the incident in a nurse's flow sheet that I didn't have access to, that I guess maybe the state got. I'm not really sure who got a hold of it first, but I know I didn't have access to it the three times I went down and requested her records. And then all of a sudden it just popped up with, I guess, the state's request. And there it was. It said on that date of service, severe stimulation with oxygen and suction due to choking. And it said that her oxygen was at 49. I mean, when I did research after that, anything below 60 can cause brain damage. She got discharged with very specific instructions for nutritional intake. Me being more of, I'm not sure if holistic is the right word, but I loved breastfeeding my babies. I wasn't too big on formula. They don't have to have it. I'd rather them not. But her discharge instructions, which I didn't know because they, like I said, they came home with my husband and I did not look at them, said for her to continue to have fortified milk like she was having in her tube feedings, which is essentially my milk mixed with a high calorie formula to adequately supply her body what she needed for bone development, for growth. She got discharged on a Friday. Her first wellness check was that Monday. I asked her pediatrician if she needed fortified milk. And since she had gained approximately 3 to 4 ounces over the weekend, she's like, "No, absolutely not." And so that's what we did. So I feel like that was a mistake.
But also, I trust my kids' pediatricians' opinions way more than when I go to the hospital and experience those doctors. You know, they don't know my child from beginning to end. They're in there looking at things much more acutely. Like, why is this child here right now? How do I get them home? My kid's pediatrician looks at them as a whole. And so I would always go with what my pediatrician says over the doctors in the hospital.
It just feels like there was just so many unfortunate missteps along the way through the pregnancy, through the NICU stay. And then maybe there's a nutritional aspect that I'm not thinking of that I might not be adequately supplying to her little baby body. You know, like you said, you trust the opinion of your pediatrician. And since, like I said, we were more of like a holistic family and I would prefer them not to be on formula, then absolutely, I'm going to go with that advice. And if she's gaining weight, then you think that's a good thing. But what you don't think about is she may be gaining weight gain, but is she developing properly? Is she getting enough minerals and nutrients for bone development? And those are the things that I didn't think through. Even her being on Polyvisol with iron, because she was anemic since birth, which she was always throwing up. And we addressed that with her pediatrician. And I told her that she was fussy here and there. Most of the time she would sleep, but that was all documented through her NICU stay. At her first wellness check, that's when she was taken off fortified breast milk. So she was just on breast milk straight for the 7 weeks that she was home. Then on her second wellness check, we complained that she was a little more fussy, sleeping all the time, not eating very well, and was throwing up quite a bit. And then not keeping down her Polyvisol again. Diagnosed with GERD and put on Famotidine.
Diagnosis of GERD and Famotidine is what they do with every child that they don't know what's wrong. It's like, we can't figure it out. It must be GERD. Jeez. You're not the first mom we've spoken with who had GERD as an explanation. So October 1, Amelia woke up and you noticed a swollen thigh. How did that come about?
With twins, you do several different processes for nighttime routine to see what works for you and your family. We tried everything. Everything was keeping me up all night, feeding both babies. So what ultimately worked for us, since like I stated, Amelia did better with bottles. She didn't latch well without a guard. My son never had a problem with latching. So I would breastfeed him throughout the night and my husband would bottle feed Amelia. And my son was like clockwork every 2 hours. So if I ended up doing both, I essentially got no sleep because they were on different schedules throughout the night. I breastfed my son all night and he ate about 3 a.m. He went back into his bassinet. Amelia then woke up. My husband would take her out to the living room because he liked to watch TV and feed her. So that's what he did about, I want to say maybe around 3:30. And he changed her diaper as part of the routine and noticed that she had a swollen right thigh. Immediately came and woke me up to come look at it. I got up, went and looked at it. It was swollen, like a little flopped, like to the side a little bit. Like she didn't want to move it. And I thought, okay, maybe it's dislocated. I don't know how, but obviously we need to take her to the emergency room. I called my mom to come watch my three-year-old who was sleeping in the bed. And then obviously my twin son, she was there probably no later than 4 something. We were in the ER and being seen by 5 something in the morning. We feel like it's an emergency situation. We just went to our local hospital, which is here in Camden County. It's Southeast Georgia Health System. So we went there first and they did an X-ray. What I thought was just her right leg, but I guess it was 12 weeks, but she was 8 pounds. So she was still teeny. Essentially the size of a newborn. Actually they did was pretty much of her whole body. And they told us her femur was broken. Me and my husband were beside ourselves, not understanding how in the world her femur was broken. And that's all they told us. And that at that point, she needed to be transferred down to Wolfson's because they didn't have an adequate pediatric orthopedic department to further assist her. And we're like, absolutely. We were just discharged 7 weeks ago. We'll go right down. They wanted to do labs at that point. I remember getting a little upset because obviously I just found out my baby is injured with a broken femur. And this nurse is going from arm to arm, back and forth, trying to get an IV line in her and holding down her wrists because she's obviously a baby, she's moving. And she wasn't getting a vein. And she went to her ankles, she went to her wrists. And finally, I just begged her to stop. Can you please just stop? Because she's obviously gone through enough at this point. I don't know what you're trying to do. Can we just stop? And so she does a heel stick instead to get a little bit of blood to check whatever she needed to check as far as labs. Everyone leaves the room and the nurse pops back in and says, ground transport is about 2 to 3 hours out. And I said, well, that's obviously way too long. She can't sit here. We need to get down there. He's like, well, you can fly her if you want to. And I said, sure, let's do it. I'll figure out that payment later. Let's go ahead and fly her down. So the flight crew gets there and it's a repeat of the same thing. They get her strapped in to the little bed and then they try to start doing an IV again from hand to hand to hand. And she's screaming. I'm like, guys, like, I understand maybe it's protocol to have a line in for emergencies, but you're torturing my baby. And so finally they give up too. I mean, so now we had 4 different people trying to put an IV in both hands, wrists, holding her down. They fly her. We follow in our car. Like, we can see the helicopter above us. When we get to Wolfson's, when we get there, I think, is when we start realizing that they're treating us differently. No one directly asked, like, what did you do to your baby? They just said, well, what happened? We're like, well, we don't know. The only thing my husband had come up with was the day prior, he said that her leg was strapped in improperly into the car seat on the ride home. That was the only thing we could think of. When we got to Wolfson's, they took her for an x-ray again. And that's when everything started snowballing. Every time the doctor came in, he was telling me something new was wrong with my baby. It went from your baby obviously has a broken femur. We knew that. Now we're seeing rib fractures in various stages of healing. And I just looked at him and I said, well, what does that mean? How old are they? How old? What do you mean by various stages of healing? Can I see them? Show me the x-ray and show me what you're talking about. No one would ever show me. I'm telling you, the doctor in the ER came in and out of our room probably a good five times. Each time the doctor would come in, he would give us what felt like new information, new injuries, not thinking clearly. I'm like, wait a minute, she's only had the x-ray. So why did you not tell me all this information at once? So he just kept coming in saying, well, now we see 8 rib fractures. Now we see 15. And I'm like, what the heck? What is going on? We need to go have a CAT scan. I said, absolutely, go for it. Again, what happened? I have no idea. We go through the motions. I think that every parent in that state goes, did we swaddle her too tightly? Did we burp her too hard? Could it have been the car seat improperly? Did her sister pick her up? One time I was holding her on the couch and my 3-year-old is jumping on the couch. Don't jump on the couch. And she accidentally jumped on us. We mentioned that. My husband said, oh my God, you know, I would feed her on the couch. Sometimes I would fall asleep with her on the couch. What if I rolled over on her? Could that have caused injury? No, none of that. No, anything that we came up with, they just kept saying, no, that couldn't have caused injury. So then I start again asking, well, you keep saying various stages of healing. Tell me, what's the oldest fracture? Oh, we don't know. There's no way to tell. They would never show me anything. And then finally, they came in, did the x-ray. So they had someone come in to make sure there was no hemorrhaging behind her eyes. And they did a CAT scan of her head. Everything came back fine. At that point, we knew they weren't trying to find out what was wrong with our child. Because as we're asking questions, I'm saying, well, she was intrauterine growth restricted. Could that have something to do with it? Did this happen in NICU? Everything was no. Not maybe, not we'll look into it, but no. Couldn't have anything to do with it. Okay, well, it was a high-risk pregnancy. No, that didn't have anything to do with that. At one point, I asked if, does she have cancer? How does she have all these injuries? No, cancer can't cause that. What about metabolic bone disorders? No, can't cause these kind of injuries. And at that point, I am hysterical, like just hysterical, because I think at that point, I think they said my baby had 20 injuries. I just looked at them. I said, she's never shown any signs of pain. She doesn't have any bruising anywhere. How does she have all these injuries?
Right. Like, where are the scars?
No signs of discomfort. We came for a swollen leg. I have pictures of her 24 hours ago and she's a happy, normal baby. I have a whole body shot. Like there's not a mark on the kid.
At this point, you had only had her for 7 weeks home from NICU, right? And they're counting dozens of injuries over various healing, yet none of them have scars or bruises.
Not one mark on her body. No bruises, no discoloration, no sign of pain or discomfort from her, except for what we complained to the pediatrician about, some fussiness that she said was, you know, associated with GERD. And she had just had a full physical exam 16 days prior to this, naked, with no cause for concern.
At this point, had you thought about the idea of whether it could have happened prenatally due to her size and the contractions, or was that something you thought about later?
That's something I thought about later. But what I did mention in the moment to the doctors was saying that she was severely intrauterine growth restricted. Can that have something to do with it? Because that's in their notes. They immediately blew it off. and said no. So my mind did go there to a certain extent.
When you say they, are you referring to a child abuse pediatrician, or was it just a number of doctors at this point?
I think it was just one ER doctor that I was dealing with at that point on the first when we got there. And then we were admitted upstairs. And that's when the child abuse pediatrician came in.
So then at this point, you get admitted, you are brought to a room upstairs, and a child abuse pediatrician approaches you.
They tricked us into getting my son down there, saying that I'm a breastfeeding mom, that he's, you know, my babies are twins. You should never separate twins. And I'm like, okay, well, my husband will then run home. We're obviously going to be here overnight. He's going to get us an overnight bag, some toothbrushes. He'll grab my son. And they were like, the nurses were just so pleasant and sweet. And they brought in a pack and play, like a little Mamaroo swing all into the room. And they're like, oh yeah, the babies need to be together. We'll bring everything in. They had everything set up. And then as soon as my husband pulled in the parking deck, she pops her head in and says, when your son gets here, we're taking him downstairs for a full workup of non-accidental trauma. And that's when everything clicked with me. Holy crap. They are not trying to find out what's wrong with my baby. And now they're taking my son.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you subscribe and follow us on social. We hope that you join us again next time and keep on fostering the future.